Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, welcome to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined as usual by Phil Bishop, editor of our online news service at theconstructionindex.com. It is Wednesday, the 24th of March, 2021. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm very well. It's a big week this week, isn't it? We've got a packed programme today. Should we get right on with it?
Yes, we shall indeed, because we have a new guest joining the podcast today. I'm very delighted to welcome Peter Launer, Chairman of the Construction Industry Training Board, or CITB. Peter has been described as the busiest man in FE, further education that is. He's chairman also of NCG, Newcastle College Group, a big further education college group in England. He's former interim CEO of the Student Loans Company, appointed chairman of that organisation in April last year. He's also former CEO of both the Institute of Apprentices and Education and Skills Funding Agency, amongst other things. Very busy man, Peter.
Well, not quite as busy as I was, because I think that quote came from when I was full-time chief executive and trying to cover one or two bases. And I'm now very pleased to be working as a non-executive and thoroughly enjoy being chair of the Construction Industry Training Board, an organisation I've had contact with in lots of ways over the years.
Yes. You've been with the CITB in that role for about 2 years now, is that right?
3 years in May.
3 years in May, right. Okay, my mistake. Okay, well, look, Peter's here to talk to us about the future of the CITB, specifically, as Phil mentioned, in the light of the surprise decision announced earlier this week that the organisation would not, after all, be selling its national construction training centres at Bertram Newton in Norfolk and Inchinnan near Glasgow. So I suppose the first question, Peter, is why? Why this change of direction? Why this U-turn?
Well, I don't really see it as a major U-turn, but it's obviously a change of direction. We set out on the important Vision 2020 programme in 2017, and I think your listeners will be very familiar with the key elements of that. You summed it up in some of your previous blogs and podcasts as moving from levy out, grant in, to levy out, skills in. So it was a much clearer, bigger focus on working with industry to make sure that industry's got the skills that it needs for the future, and cutting out some of the things that had grown up over the years, which were important parts of the industry, but which others could do better. And that led to the decision to divest ourselves of card schemes, of a qualifications awarding body, and to look for purchases of the various branches, if I can use that word, of the National Construction College. We found buyers for a lot of these functions, but we always said that we would put the needs of employers in the industry first, and we would ensure that training was retained. Now, I think some of the sales that we've done will lead to an expansion of training, and that will be good. But we didn't find buyers for the training businesses at Bertram, Newton and Inchinnan. And we felt that after a couple of years of significant uncertainty, we needed to give confidence to employers that needed these specialised skills that we would be able to continue, and also confidence to staff. They'd had 2 years of uncertainty. There were no buyers on the horizon for the specialised elements of these businesses, and therefore we said we need to consolidate, we need to make sure that the training is provided, it's time to take a slightly different approach. But we've made huge strides with Vision 2020, saved very large amounts of money that we can invest back in skills for the construction industry, and have started to do that. So I think Vision 2020 has been a great success. So this is tacking in the way that a yacht might tack rather than a U-turn. And we've achieved a lot of the objectives of Vision 2020.
Can I ask, as I understand it, the reason for keeping the colleges open was because there were certain elements, certain courses that the commercial sector was not going to be able to, there was a risk that the commercial sector was not going to be able to adequately provide. And therefore, in support of the industry, you're standing by these two colleges. What specific courses are we talking about? Because I'm sure some of the courses the commercial sector could cope with fine. Which were the courses which were at risk?
So the main specialised training offerings that we're talking about are scaffolding at Bircham and in Chinnan, plants operating at Bircham and in Chinnan. So particularly in the biggest area where there weren't other providers stepping up was scaffolding. I don't know if you've ever been to Bircham, but it is...
A long time ago.
Well, you'd probably still recognise it. The same hangars, and did you see the very large site where we do plant operating training?
Yes.
And there's probably no other site with quite that extensive opportunity to provide all kinds of plant operating training on the same site and within a short period of time. So it is quite specialised, and a lot of the mainstream trades are perfectly adequately picked up by others. And we did have buyers that were interested, and it's been difficult economic climate over the last couple of years, hasn't it? And the buyers dropped out, and we said, look, we've achieved a lot. We've sold a number of aspects of the business. We've got a good return to the CITB and to employers that we can invest back in skills. But it's time to draw a line and make sure that we continue that training and make sure it's fit for purpose for the future.
So will you maintain the full spectrum of courses that you have at those two colleges, or will you cease to deliver the courses which are perfectly adequately delivered by private sector commercial competitors and just focus on the courses which are not adequately provided by the commercial sector?
So we've always constantly reviewed the provision that we have, and I'm not saying that we wouldn't provide other things as well, but we will focus in particular on these areas because those are the reasons why we've kept the businesses going. And scaffolding training is there's a big demand for that in London and the South East and in the central belt of Scotland. We did think that other providers would have stepped up to the plate, but they came forward but then got off the plate. And no hard feelings about that, no blame attached. People need to make the right commercial decision for them, but it was what was absolutely essential for us was to maintain that provision.
But it seems to me you do all sorts of, the widest range. I think you also do sort of soft skills and management training and these sort of things through the colleges. Will they continue, or will it be going back to old school trades?
Well, we do a range of training, and we will review that on a proper business cycle basis. But the real focus and the reason for the change of direction is the trades that I've outlined. But we're also maintaining health and safety training, partly because that's so fundamental for the whole industry. We've also radically changed the way a lot of that's provided in response to the pandemic. We've made it very, a lot of it is online. We work with Pearson as our provider of that. So we've decided to keep that for now, and while it's all developing and adjusting to the new environment. So we need to look at what we do there in a new light and say, well, what's right for the future? What supports other things? What do we need to provide for continuity? And we'll keep that under review. And but we've got no immediate plans to change what we do at Bircham or in Chinnan. No doubt you'll ask in a minute, will we go back to market? Well, we've no plans to do that. We actually think it's important to consolidate on what we've done, but no part of the business is sacrosanct and can be kept going. If it's not right for the business, we'll keep all of that closely under review. But I want employers to take confidence that, particularly those that have used scaffolding and plant operating training, I want employers to take confidence that we will continue to provide these and meet the demand that there is that we can't see being easily provided elsewhere.
You've just preempted my next question, actually, Peter, by saying, you know, will you go back to market, which was going to be what I was going to say. But clearly this, if you look at the strategy which CITB has been evolving in recent years, keeping the training centres wasn't ever going to be part of that. So this is a slight diversion, it seems to me. Will it change any other aspects of the CITB strategy? The way, you know, your emphasis, for example, was to modernise, on modernising skills delivery and that kind of thing. Has there been any change in overall strategy as a result of this, or is this just a sort of sideshow?
I wouldn't describe this as a sideshow because okay. the training in scaffolding and in plant operating training is absolutely vital for the industry. And although I've described it as in yachting terms, although I'm not a sailor, so if there are sailors listening, they might think, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. It's sort of tacking in a slightly different direction. It's in line with what we always said. We said we would never let training that was needed fall away. I mean, how could we possibly justify that as the training board for the industry? But there's lots of other training that we've and functions, the card schemes, the award schemes, that others are actually better placed to do. And what we have done in the college has always been restricted to the scope of our footprint in the industry. And I think some of the organisations that have taken over the college will be able to broaden that out, and that will be to the benefit of the industry. So I think this is a good decision for industry. In no way does it change the wider ambitions of Vision 2020, which you're quite right, was to look at future skill needs. And I think this must be one of the most important junctures in skills in the construction industry, because not only are we now in a position where your labour market in the industry is always balanced through immigration. That began to change a couple of years ago and will change further after Brexit. We need to grow our own more and more in this country. So one large element of what we've been focusing on is making better information about the industry, seeking to explain to people what great careers there are in construction. And we're also looking at modernising skills, looking at the skills that we needed for modern methods of construction. There's obviously a strand of work that we've been researching on the skills needed that will come out of the Grenfell report, which will be a major challenge for the industry, and look at the green agenda, which is a hugely exciting agenda for the industry. And construction, I think, has got to lead the way on the green agenda. And we're going to need thousands upon thousands of people with skills to install heat pumps or hydrogen boilers. So wherever you look, there are really big skills challenges that the industry needs to tackle. And our role is not to do it all, but to work with industry, to help industry identify those skills, to get the recruits that we need, to look at all the recruitment channels like apprenticeships. We're looking very hard at how we can help more learners from full-time further education courses get into the industry. We're looking at the, in England, at the government's T levels. We've got to look at all those strands if we're going to fulfil the functions of a body that is not doing everything itself, but is taking the commissioning role and investing employers' levy wisely for the benefit of the whole industry.
CITB Vision 2020, it makes it clear that you do not ideally want to be in the business of the direct delivery of training. The fact that you've decided to keep two colleges open is a result of the, as you mentioned, scaffolding, plant operator training. There is inadequacy in the commercial sector to meet industry needs, and therefore you're effectively stepping in or remaining in as sort of provider of last resort, which rather suggests that these are not economically attractive or economically viable activities, which must therefore put a dent in your financial strategy. If these aren't profitable activities, if they were profitable activities, I'm sure lots of people would want to step into it. Therefore, I assume they're not profitable activities, and therefore that's going to have an impact on your finances going forwards, isn't it?
We've drawn up plans for the our business plan, which will be published next week, which take account of the decision that we've made. And we've drawn up the overall plan and made significant savings that I referred to earlier compared with the pre-Vision 2020 plan. And I'm sure you're aware that we made further operating savings in last autumn, which we reflected in the plan that we published next week. So we have allowed for the costs that would have that we'll need to make sure that the colleges can operate successfully. We're also planning to sort of develop site strategies for both Inchinnan and Glasgow, which is you probably haven't been to Inchinnan. But it's actually a great site. It's quite a small site. It's not like a big site like Bircham. It's quite a small site. It's out at Glasgow Airport. We'll be able to let off a space that we don't need and car parking space there and still do the training that we don't think will be provided in the market. So we'll reduce the costs of the site. Similarly, at Bircham, where you have been, Bircham is...
It's a huge site, isn't it? How big is it?
It's 350 acres. We've sold about 170 acres. Sorry, I think it's 370 acres. We've sold about 170 acres of that, which wasn't being used as part of the site. We've sold that to a local farmer that's being fenced off and developed into agricultural land. Obviously, that reduces the overall site costs. There are actually some other people that are interested in using parts of the site. So we'll do whatever we can to use the site efficiently, to defray any of the costs, and actually taking a bit more of a, instead of selling the whole site, we'll be more open to using parts of that. So we'll, as we always do, we'll try and maximise the amount available for skills and minimise our operating costs.
So bottom line, how much will they cost you?
The board asked for a full site strategy for Inchinnan and Bircham Newton at its August meeting. But the business plan that we publish next week will set out full detail of our income and expenditure, actually for the next 4 years, but concentrating on 21-22. So you can see the full details in that.
Wait and see. Okay. Thank you.
Peter, just finally, the lack or the shortage of skills in the construction industry is a sort of a constant preoccupation for the industry. I just wondered how you felt the future looks now. I mean, we've had Brexit, we've had COVID, all these other things feeding into the into the issue and making things even more complicated. How optimistic are you about us being able to satisfy our need for fresh recruits into the industry?
So I am optimistic, some reasons for optimism. First, I think the industry is working better together than it's ever worked. A couple of weeks ago, the Construction Leadership Council published its skills plan, and you'll see complete alignment between that skills plan for the whole industry, which goes beyond training and skills into culture and employment practices and support. You'll see an alignment of the skills elements of that plan with our business plan that we publish next week. So we've clearly been working very closely with that. Sarah Beale chairs the skills panel.
Sarah Beale's your chief executive of the CITB.
Yes, that's right. Sorry, I should have made that clear. And so Sarah chairs the skills panel for the Construction Leadership Council. And you'll see a very close alignment between that plan and the more detail that you'll see in our business plan next week. So that industry working together, I think, is better than it's ever been. And actually, huge credit to the Construction Leadership Council and their counterparts in Scotland and Wales. During the pandemic, the industry recognised the need to work together to establish safe COVID practices on site, complete change for the way sites work. Some really good work was done as part of that. And I think that same application is now being applied to the skills agenda. Secondly, I do think we're now seeing many more young people thinking that construction is a career for them. We put a lot of effort with a lot of partners into the Go Construct website, and 750,000 people are using that to educate themselves about the 170 different occupations you can follow in the huge breadth that is the construction industry. So I think we're seeing a better front end. And then what we're working on as well is better opportunities for adults to retrain and join the industry. And we're working very closely with government on that. Over the last year, we've been running construction skills hubs linked to sites where people can get the site experience that can help them get a job on a site. Otherwise, you're in a catch-22, aren't you? You can't get a job on a site without the site experience. These skills hubs are providing the opportunity for site experience, and we're seeing good results there. And we're working also closely with government to develop traineeships for 18 to 24-year-olds to help, again, young people get that experience, but get the qualifications that will enable them to start in the industry. We want to link that to fast-track apprenticeships. And the first specification for one of these traineeships, which would typically be 6 months, will be for bricklaying. That will be out in May, and then others will follow from August onwards in many of the other construction trades. So lots of new approaches being taken. And I do think that industry recognises as well that it's got to change its practices. Again, lots of interesting things on that, including talk about more direct employment, which I think would be good for skills and for employment in the industry. So I think lots of things coming together now. And I am optimistic about the future.
Great stuff. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Well, thank you to Peter Launer. Although, as I said last week, whenever I hear anyone talk about Go Construct, the CITB careers website, I have this Welsh opera singer in my head. Go Construct! Anyway, moving on. Next subject. Another big story of this week. I say this week. It's one that's been rumbling for 47 years, can you believe?
Yes, incredible.
But the Shrewsbury pickets. You probably remember, you're probably working for Construction News when the National Building
Shut
Strike
up.
Happened in 1972, weren't you?
No, but it was still very much a live topic when I was working at Construction News, which is going back well over 20 years. But back in 1972, there was a National Builders Strike, wasn't there? I don't know if there's ever been a construction strike since then, but National Building Strike. We've discussed the lump, haven't we? And employment practices back in the Stone Age. Well, this is back in the Stone Age, 1972. And there was a lot of discontent amongst the workforce about working conditions, pay, that kind of thing. And it culminated in a national strike. And there were flying pickets flying around all over the place. I don't know exactly the circumstances of the event which led to their arrest, but they were, I think it was 24 workers went on strike. It was presumably UCAT or TNG, I can't remember.
I think both, but it's more than 24 that were on strike, of course. It's just that 24 guys and the rural guys, 24 guys were charged with,
yes,
you know, affray, intimidation and conspiracy and this sort of thing after the strike had ended. And it was all terribly political. It was all, this is the era of the Economics League, the blacklist and all of this, that and the other.
Yes.
Anyway, it's finally come to the Court of Appeal. Some of these guys were, six of them were sent to prison, and others had suspended prison sentences and other non-custodial sentences. And they've all along said this is completely unfair. And it seems to me, thanks largely to the extraordinary work of the woman called Eileen Turnbull, who's the researcher and secretary of the Shrewsbury Pickets campaign, she spent years digging through all the evidence and discovered that witness statements were destroyed by the police, or by the prosecution or the police, or that side, and that prejudiced the trial.
There was also, there was a television documentary,
That's
wasn't
it.
There?
Yes, yes, Reds Under the Beds. The night before, it was the night before the jury were supposed to deliver their verdict or whatever.
Which is outrageous. You wouldn't think it possible.
There's an awful lot to this, and I think I would invite encourage anyone who's at all interested in this to go to the website shrewsbury24campaign.org.uk. That's 24, the digits rather than the words, shrewsbury24campaign.org.uk. And it's got the full background of the people involved and the what they went through and so on, and how they never worked again because they were blacklisted. And famously, of course, one of them was Eric, better known as Ricky Tomlinson, who went on, I think his first job was starring in a Ken Loach film, and then went on to be in Brookside and perhaps most famously The Royal Family.
Yeah.
But he was just one of the 24. Anyway, the 14 of them were carrying on this campaign right up to the Court of Appeal, which has this week ruled that they are cleared of all charges 47 years later. Several of them have already passed away, so it's sad that they never got to saw the day. But it's, as has been said by all sorts of people, it was a serious miscarriage of justice, and it's quite a saga. And there, I am sure, has to be a movie about this. A film has to be made on this.
Probably it's by Ken Loach, I should think. Yeah,
well, quite possibly.
I mean, of course, the reason that we have Ricky Tomlinson on our screens now, something we should all be grateful for, is that he was blacklisted. I mean, after he served his sentence and came out of prison, there was no way he was ever going to get a job in construction again. And so he had to turn his hand to other things, and he happened to be... happened to have a talent for acting, which is obviously something which he did extremely well. But obviously he was one of the lucky ones. Other people came through this, and again, that was their construction career over, and they never really recovered. And who was the lead picket? I can't remember his name.
Des Warren.
He was leading picket. I mean, he never worked again. He came out, I can't remember when he died.
He died in 2004, age 67.
Right.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Never working again.
Yeah, which is terrible. And so, yes, it's a rather Pyrrhic victory for people like Des Warren and the other people who have since passed away. But I think probably it's it's a victory for the industry itself, because it puts an end to a pretty sordid episode.
Is it a victory for that? I think, I don't... I mean, it's a good thing, but I think if you talk about the industry establishment, I don't think it comes out of it terribly well, to be honest.
Well, no, maybe it comes out of it with its tail between its legs, but I think it's, you know, this was an open sore for nearly 50 years, and the fact that we now have sort of, I suppose, the fashionable word is closure. You know, we can put it to bed now. I mean, I know we know that the blacklisting episode carried on a long time after this, and only very recently.
Well, some would say it still happens.
Yeah,
depending how you define it. I don't know how formal it is, but
yes. But of course, this was systemic.
Yes,
there was a database, a list that was circulated to all the major employers. I think it's just a, yes, maybe you can't say that blacklisting and dodgy employment practices are a thing of the past. They're not made history by this, but I think it's a huge step forward, and I think that most people would welcome the ruling, and everybody should, really. Well, now it's deja vu time. Because almost exactly this time last year, just after Boris Johnson announced the first national lockdown in response to COVID-19, that week on Reconstruction, we welcomed a specialist in remote learning to the podcast. And in fact, she was our very first guest, and she's back again. She is Jackie Bishop. She's a learning and development consultant. She runs her own management training and development business called BBD Consult. And she is, as I pointed out last year, she is Phil's wife. Jackie was here telling us about almost exactly a year ago, telling us how to cope with remote working under lockdown conditions. And so we've brought her back this year on the anniversary, as it were, to see how she thinks things have changed and whether or not the methods that she discussed last year have been widely adopted. I suspect that they have. Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us what's changed in the last year.
Probably your hair's gotten longer.
It got very short back in the summer. Go on.
What's changed in the last year? Well, if it started at the beginning, I think when we went into lockdown, people suddenly working remotely, it was a bit of a shock. But most of us developed habits and ways, routines to make it work for us. That's great, but that's thrown up a lot more challenges because although we are finding people have more routines, they tend toward bad habits. And I include myself in that. So it's not an accusation for anybody listening. So what has changed? Generally, we appear to be working longer hours. Now, the reason for that is most of us commute in some capacity to work.
Or used to.
Yes, on the days we were allowed out. And a lot of us are starting work immediately. And so instead of taking the commuting time as downtime, we're using it to do extra work. So the working days expanded. And that's not surprising for those that were homeschooling, trying to school the kids, trying to manage the domestic life, as well as working. So generally, we're starting earlier and finishing later.
Yes. Well, that is a problem with working from home, which is something I've been doing since 1998. And that is certainly the case. I mean, it gives you, working from home gives you the flexibility, I suppose, that you can work when you want to. But also, you're not so constrained. You're not thinking, oh, I'm at work, therefore I must knuckle down. You're very easily distracted and you've got to use a lot of self-discipline to keep yourself on task. And that's why, yeah, you're absolutely right. The working day can stretch out far beyond where it should.
Yeah, and it's interesting, David, because there seems to be two, and I'm doing this from my experience working with clients, some of us get easily distracted and we're pulled towards the house, doing other things, stroking the cat. At the end of the day, you might shut down, you've got 10 windows open in the background, thinking, oh, I forgot that. But then we have other people who are if they're working at a screen, they're there 8, 10, 11 hours a day without actually taking breaks. And if you think in an office environment, we're always waving to someone or someone's stopping by our desk. So what's tending to happen is this blue light for 10, 12 hours a day is really impacting on one, on eyesight, but two, on well-being. So it seems we seem to have gone both ends of that spectrum.
That's very interesting. Have you noticed any of your clients changing the way they operate in any significant way as a result of this?
Yes. Now, what seems to be happening, what is happening is that because of the disconnect, so I'm not seeing colleagues regularly, I can't go for a quick coffee to catch up. People are trying to find ways to keep those open relationships, keep up to date with the projects going, keep up to date with each other. So what seems to have happened is people are on back-to-back calls, conference calls particularly, a lot of hours in the day because people are trying to find that connection. And don't forget, a lot of us get our social energy, our social those social interactions at work really do motivate us and keep us going. So we're trying to emulate the social situations. We're trying to keep up to date with projects. We're trying to keep up to date with everything. So it's back-to-back calls. So we're back to the longer hours, David. Starting earlier, going on to calls, not coming off calls to perhaps 3 o'clock in the afternoon and go back to work, as it were. So all of it combined really does have an impact in the way we're working.
Jackie, you've been working with companies from different countries. What have you learned about how different cultures have adapted to working from home? And what maybe can other countries teach British people about what we should or might be thinking about when we work from home or do remote working?
Yeah, and it's a really good question, but I can only do this from observation. So I tend to work with groups from America, North America, from groups across the UK, then groups across EMEA and groups across the Asia Pac region. Now, what's fascinating and jumps out at me every time I interact with these different regions is that my European clients tend to miss the office environment much more than perhaps the British clients and the American clients. And that is really interesting when you interact with these guys because colleagues working in Portugal, Spain, France, they're desperate to get back to the office. Or when you talk to people who are based in the UK, they're going, no, I'll go back to the office one day a week, but I don't want to do it full time. So there's a real dichotomy there. What I'm finding, again, this is personal observation, I haven't researched it thoroughly yet, is if we look at our colleagues in the Asia regions, they're quite happy with the longer hours. So they're quite used to working into the evenings, and it seems to come across that working culture has remained. However, what I've also observed is they're often in smaller accommodation, smaller apartments, sometimes living with multi-generational families. So they're trying to do the work while grandparents are in the background, my mother and father are cooking lunch. So it's really interesting just seeing those differences. But again, I'm doing this as a quick answer to a question. It's not formal research.
When you deliver your training under normal circumstances, I mean, I suppose these might now be normal circumstances, but before COVID, were you dealing with people who were in an office environment? So were you dealing with people in groups? And do you find yourself now delivering your services to people in their homes, people on their own?
Yes, right. Two ways to that, David. I did both. I've been doing remote learning and development for many years simply because some clients I had moved into that environment very early on. Offices cost money. Simple as that. Let's get rid of desks.
Of course.
So I did both. But the main difference is that now every single session people are working from home. And that's very different. So what we're seeing is even on the remote sessions, so we've gotten into the hybrid team environment. I'm sure you've heard these terms becoming the norm, where some team members would be in an office that day and other team members might be at home.
Yes.
So what we're seeing, because everyone, almost everyone is working from home, a lot fewer people on camera. They don't like the backgrounds being seen.
Oh, I see.
So that's been really interesting. It's kind of a little tiny side issue, but it is it's very obvious. And whereas in the old days, before everyone was at home, even in the hybrid model, more people would be in the office and be happy to have that office environment in the background on camera.
Apart from people working longer hours, what else have we learned about working from home in the past year?
Well, this is really fascinating. We're more productive. So we tend a bit, well, let me rephrase that. About two thirds of us feel that we are more productive. We get more done. Now, you've got to question that because is it because we're working longer hours?
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
Feel more productive. But what's really interesting is their workspace, the more motivation they're able to maintain. So if you have somewhere at home, a desk in the corner of the bedroom, if you have your home office, fantastic, you're in luxury. But if you feel positive about the area where you're working, you tend to maintain motivation.
That's interesting. I mean, I find sometimes, I don't know if you've noticed this, this is just an observation as well. Sometimes I get really fed up with my office environment. You know, I come down here and I spend all day down here. And so sometimes I just need a change of scene and I go up and I work in the kitchen. I mean, I've got a laptop computer. I just unplug everything, take it up with me, and I work in the kitchen just for a morning or something like that. And the change of scene, you know, they say a change is as good as a rest. It changes the dynamic. And so when I get stuck in a rut down in the office, I go up to the kitchen. It seems to work.
That's really good practice. And David, let me just ask you this, putting you right in the spot. Do you get outside every day?
Yes, not as much as I should. I walk the dog first thing in the morning and I tell myself I'll walk it again at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't.
That poor dog, I hope someone's taking him out.
Well, I've got most of the family are here so that we can take it in turns. So she gets plenty of exercise, but maybe I don't get as much as I should.
And why don't you go out in the afternoon, David?
It's a lack of self-discipline, actually, Jackie. It's because I think, oh, hang on a second. It's 3 o'clock. I've only got two more hours before I have to go and start cooking dinner or whatever I have to do. I'd better knuckle down now because I've been, you know, sort of swinging the lead up until 3 o'clock. And now, oops, I don't have much time left. So that's full disclosure there.
Those hours without taking breaks. So one of the big things there, and a change is as good as a rest, you're absolutely right, working in another room. What's even better, you might think, I can't walk the dog for 2 hours, that's impossible, I'm too busy. Mm-hmm. But even getting outside for 10 minutes, being outside, interacting with our environment is really, really powerful for enhancing well-being. So it's 10 minutes of being outside, paying attention. If you're in a busy road, listen to the cars, listen to the traffic. If you're in the country, listen to the birds. But just that 10 minute of air will lift your motivation. And because you've physically moved, it dries up your energy. And most of us think, I can't take a break. I haven't got the time. David, you just said it. I didn't even pay you in advance for that. You set yourself up.
Yeah, I think that everybody said, when I first started working from home, which as I mentioned was a long, long time ago, people asked me, don't you find it difficult to focus and to concentrate? And don't you get easily distracted? And in actual fact, back then I didn't. I was lucky because when I started out as a freelance, I had quite a lot of work and I had to knuckle down because there wasn't the space to get distracted. And so I didn't find that a problem. It was only later when things became more routine and things weren't as new and I wasn't so excited about doing what I was doing, to be perfectly honest. That's when the insidious distractions start to creep in. And I do think that the biggest challenge about working from home is self-discipline.
Well, going back, if you say before COVID and post-COVID, if you like, but before COVID, you wanted to get it all done because you had a life outside of work. You might have been going to a restaurant that evening. You might have been going to one of your children at school, going and seeing what's going on. Mm-hmm. You might have been meeting a friend for a beer. You know, I don't have that stimulation where I've got to get it all done today because I'm doing something the evening. Now, what are you doing? Walking upstairs to your dining room, which you visited 10 times today. So you haven't got that excitement and that drive. Let's get it out of the way and have real life, because we're doing very little else. So what we're doing is being distracted at work to try and keep the brain stimulated.
Yes, of course. Phil, how self-disciplined are you? Do you find yourself drifting off and watching endless YouTube videos when you should be working?
I am perfect in every way. That's all I'm going to say.
Actually, should I be answering that one for you, David?
No. Yeah, I think you should, Jackie, actually. I know you can tell me later what the truth is. But you both work from the same location, more or less, don't you?
Well, we're in the luxurious position of having different offices, different rooms that we work in. So that is.
I have a spare bedroom, and she has an office we had built above the garage a few years ago. So we kept well apart during working hours.
You're in close proximity, but you're not so close that you would distract each other.
But David, it's a really good question because I've worked with people who are in apartments in central cities, and there's maybe 3-4 of them sharing apartments. Obviously, if you're early in your career paying rent, you need to share an apartment. And what you have is 3, 4, 5 people in the same apartment, same house, all trying to be in conference calls, all trying to use Wi-Fi, all trying to use the kitchen. So, you know, we're back to that working space. It's really important to be productive. So that's why Phil is so productive, because he has a bedroom he works
in. Has his own place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, have you got a bed in your bedroom, Phil?
Nope.
So you don't just go and have a little lie down every now and then.
I just sleep in my chair.
Yeah. Well, it's... here we are again, a year on, still locked down. Well, not locked down quite so tightly, but still working from home and doing remote working. And I suppose for a lot of us, it's become second nature. For us personally, it was second nature already. But I suppose for a lot of people, it's been good, and for others, extremely frustrating.
Will it continue, though? Will it continue for... Obviously, David and I are going to carry on working in our respective homes, but for the large organisations that you work with, Jack, is there a sense that they are in a hurry to get people back into the office, or do you think that this is... that they've discovered a brilliant new way of working that they're going to keep?
Unclear yet. And I think what's really interesting there, David, is what you've just said. For some people, they're just crying. They're screaming to get back into the office. For others, so there's a lot of... for others, they just don't want to go back full time. So there's a lot of diversity in how we feel about this. So from what I'm gathering, the people I'm working with, the companies I'm working with, are looking at a hybrid model. We're back to that nice word we're using every day in this environment, in that there will be days in the office, but they will also facilitate working from home. And after a year, we've pretty much got the tech sorted out, so we can oscillate between home and work. So it looks like it's going to be a hybrid model.
I suspect that there's also an age difference here. My daughter is 26. She lives and works in London, and she obviously thrives in the office environment. And when I remember back to when I was her age and working in London, it was an exciting place to be. You know, she's in Bond Street. She's got all the facilities that the area can offer. Only she's not there at the moment because she's in a dining room in Brixton instead of being in an office in Bond Street. And she finds it very frustrating. She misses her colleagues. So she would be delighted to get back to the office as soon as she gets the opportunity. I suspect that a lot of people of maybe our generation, we're more comfortable with, you know, with the isolation. We've had office politics, you know, and, you know, it's quite nice to be on your own for a change.
It's not just that. The younger people, for obvious reasons, generally don't have the benefit of the home environments that we've got.
No, that's true.
What we know, and this is from research, so this isn't just observation, although I experience it, is Generation Zs and Millennials, so the younger part of the generation. Mm-hmm. I wish I was one of them.
Hang on, how old are Gen Zs? Generation Z are what age?
New grads, people coming in early in their career. So more early career Generation Z, 26, David's daughter, perfect example, are finding it the most challenging. Now, a couple of things there. Again, Phil, you've just mentioned it. When the home environment is perhaps, you know, early career is not as conducive to working from home. So we're right back to where we started. Get your workspace right. Whether it's a desk in the bedroom, it doesn't matter. Get that workspace right. You're more likely to keep the motivation up. But Generation Z, David, you're right. It's that disconnect. We're not getting that connection and that energy from others. So that's a really fascinating one.
Yeah, and I think you're right about the stage in somebody's career. Early in your career, isolation is not a good idea, really. You need to mix with people. You're learning from them. So you need that interaction far more than you do later in your career when you're a bit of an old fossil and basically do your own thing anyway.
Well, that's it. And also early in your career, you learn just by observing, hearing conversations, just seeing how people structure their day. So even with a formal induction program, a lot of the learning about what goes on in this company, in this organization, is simply being in it. But don't forget the millennials perhaps have young children and they've been homeschooling and trying to do their day job, homeschool, as well as so, you know, that's absolutely right. Those more early in their careers. I'll try to say it the right way.
I predict we might also see an upturn in the coming months as all this starts to ease off, an upturn in people who've been mulling about when to retire. Might start thinking now might be a good time to retire rather than going back to the office. They might think they've been enjoying watching Blue Swimmin and Countdown every day and don't want to start missing it again.
Does that answer your question, David?
It does. It makes perfect sense as well. Yeah, I think that people who maybe thought, well, I've only got a few more years to go, they might find that their employer is quite happy to give them early retirement. They might do a few sums and find, actually, I can afford to retire early. And who wants to carry on working under these circumstances at the end of their career? You know, they might just think that it's a good time to call it a day. If that's the case, that might be a good thing for the whole industry and for the entire workforce, because it'll suck in new blood from below, and that can only be a good thing.
Not that David or I have got any such ideas. We're going to keep going till we're 90, aren't we, David?
I've got to keep my nose to the grindstone, folks.
Well, I hope we're not having this second annual review in a year's time of working from home, and I think 1 year of it is probably enough for most people, but let's see what happens next, eh?
Yes.
Thank you very much to our second guest, two guests in 1 week. Is that enough for this week, David? Are we done?
We've covered a lot of ground. We've had two guests on, which is a great achievement, I think, for us. And of course, it means that people haven't had to listen to just you and me for half an hour. So I think it's time to wind it up, Phil, and say goodbye.
Great stuff. Thank you once again, everyone, for listening to Reconstruction. He's been David Taylor. I've been Phil Bishop. We'll be back again the same time next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.